everybody. This is Armand DeMille with you at the Positive Mind here on WBAI 99.5 FM on your dial. And today, we're bringing you some important, interesting stuff. We're going to be talking more about music. Music, you listen to that theme music every time I go on the air. You know what that theme music is? A guy named Dan Greenberg, many years ago, wrote this piece called Dreams of Children. And I heard it and I said, boy, that really sounds a lot like what my attitude is towards life. So I started playing it, and then I realized that I should ask his permission. And I sent him a letter, and he was with a group called Shadow Facts. I sent him a letter asking him if I could use it as theme music. And he said, he gave us permission. He said, sure, here it is, use this as your theme music. Use it now and use it forever. And he did that in writing, and then he died. And it was the last actual gesture. So although I've been encouraged by many people to change the theme music after 20 years, I say, nah, let's keep Dan around with us for a while. Music has that power. The power of music, the incredible depth of it, the usage of it, where it comes from. Why do we have it? What are we humans doing with music in our ears? Music is such a silly thing. I mean, it's... You know, do the birds use music, or are birds music? The other day, a woman said to me on the phone that the only music she likes to listen to is the sound of nature. And I said, well, that's music. And I said that offhandedly, but then I wondered, what do the birds like to listen to? The sound of humans? You know, what is it? What is this stuff? So today we're going to start investigating, doing our second investigation into the meaning of music, and my very favorite two guests. My co-host, Dr. Sherry Siegel, is with us today. Hi, Sherry.
Hi, Armand.
And with us by phone, for no good reason other than storm, is Dr. Connie Tamiano. Connie, are you there?
Yes, I am. Thanks, Armand.
Good. Could you talk as loud as you can into your telephone?
Sure.
Because we're doing, that's even better. And I want to ask you something. Why are you not here? And, Michael, this is for you, just so that you could create an image in your mind.
Well, I live up north of Peekskill in Putnam County, and not only did we get 4 to 5 inches of snow last night, but then we had icy rain on top of that. And I live in the woods with a very long driveway, and there was no way my car would make it up the hill to get on the road to get to the city today.
So those of you who are waiting for the winter to come, Connie will tell you, just go on up to Peekskill.
It's here.
So, Connie, thank you so much for doing this by phone. Sure. Not exactly what we hope for, so maybe next week or the week after we'll have you here. Because I find in person talking to you, I feel a harmony, an exchange, like we grew up on the same block. Not only do we have the same accent, but it's like we're from the same neighborhood, and somehow we both know something about music that we're not telling the world. So I want to get it out of you, and I want you to get it out of me.
Sure.
And Sherry Siegel is also somebody who's very taken by music, and as a neurologist herself, as a physical neurologist, she sees the effect of music on people, with people. So we're going to talk all about this today. Mm-hmm. Let's start it off with you, Sherry, if you would. Could you tell me, where does music come from?
Well, Armand, sometimes one of the things that I wondered about, is there a lobe in the brain that perceives music? But I think we have to go back even further. It's what really is music? And, Connie, you and I were talking about that at the conference.
Right.
We had a wonderful conference last week at Purchase College. I believe it was mentioned last week. I just found it so exciting. Connie, what is it about? How would you define music?
Well, you know, it's interesting because music isn't just one thing. When we listen to a song, we're listening to rhythms. We're listening to melodies. We're listening to harmonies, and we're also attaching to those sounds emotions and associations that become fixed with the music itself. And because of all those factors, there's not one particular part of the brain that is the music part of the brain. For example, the right temporal lobe is responsible for pitch perception, but it's not responsible for rhythmic perception.
Right. I had done some reading on this and found out, actually, by looking at Daniel Levitan's great book, Your Brain on Music. He talks about the hair cells in the basilar membrane of the inner ear. That was fascinating to me, that there are actually hair cells.
Could you explain that to me? Hair cells in the basal membrane of the ear?
Sure. There's actually little hair fibers in the basal membrane in the ear that vibrate at different frequencies. So when you hear like 40 hertz or 120 hertz, there's specific hair cells that vibrate to those frequencies and then send those signals into the temporal lobe that interpret that as the pitch that we hear.
And as I understand it, that temporal lobe has an actual map
of
all the different pitches.
It's a tonotopic map that goes in order of the pitch.
And the way he explained it in the book is that if a vibration of 440 hertz goes in to the ear, it actually lights up in the brain at 440 hertz frequency, which is amazing.
Right.
There's probably no other phenomenon that's as pure as sound is appreciated by the brain.
Absolutely.
Well, so we lizards, right, inherited this sound mechanism so that we could hear, probably to protect us from danger, right? I mean, the whole idea of it is, number one, hear something you could either eat or have sex with, right, which is what we still do today. Either find a place to go eat or find a place to have sex. Let's use music for that.
Survival.
Right? The reptiles are doing the same thing. How would they use it as a defense?
Well, if just imagine someone's, an animal's ability to hear was impaired, that they couldn't hear or they couldn't interpret the sounds, then really they wouldn't be able to run away from danger. But as animals evolved, not only could they perceive the sound, but their brains were able to interpret, it's coming from this direction and I have to run that way.
Mm.
And it could be something big because I hear it vibrating at a low pitch.
So that's why stereo is so important, stereo hearing and being able to hear. You know, like when we do vision, they tell you, well, we could remove one eye or we could block out one eye, but then you'll have monocular vision, which gives you no depth perception. And you may not think that's very dangerous to have no depth perception, but it's real important to know if the tiger's 5 feet away or 100 feet away. Same thing with ears. Your ears being bifurcated. Is that the right way to use that?
Bifurcated. Beautiful.
Right? Your bifurcated ears are telling you to hear from the right or left which way it's coming from. And then it's backed up by your vision. That's very interesting. I wonder what comes first, taste, vision, or hearing?
Well, you know, hearing actually is... There's been some research that the auditory perception is actually formed in utero in the fetus 5 months before it's born.
And so, therefore, earlier than smell, taste, vision?
Yep.
No kidding.
Absolutely. The other important thing, and this has to do with the animal instinct, that the auditory nerve splits. You know, from the ear, there's a vestibular branch that stimulates the brainstem and some of the... basic functions, things like balance and whatever. But the other part, the cochlear branch of the auditory nerve, has an immediate connection to the amygdala. From what I understand from talking to neuroscientists, that's only one synapse, which means that if a sudden sound should happen, that because of our animal background, we have this immediate reaction and response either to fight or flight. It's the fight-or-flight part of the brain. If it's important, if it's a fire alarm, we jump out of our chair and know we need to run to shelter. If it's an animal and they hear a lion roar, they know they have to hide. So without thinking, without the higher cortex, the more advanced part of the brain, making sense of what the sound is, we instinctually have an impulse to move.
Right, so it just goes to our the center that sends out information and tells the body what to do. So we don't really have to interpret it.
That's exactly right.
And so that begins at a very early age. And as it develops, how does hearing develop in a child, in a baby, for example?
Well, you know, like all sensory processing in newborn children, they need to interpret the world as they experience it. So as a child gets exposed to different types of sounds, we know, for example, that a newborn infant has a very wide range of auditory perception. And then they fine-tune their hearing depending on their environment and the culture. So say if a child is born in an Asian culture, they'll be able to learn the nuances of very tiny pitch changes that mean different things in language. You know, ma and ma sound like the same way, but I believe they're two different words in Chinese or something like that. So a child has these abilities upon birth to really have a wide range of perceptual abilities. And then the brain changes, and you probably know this through the way the neurons differentiate with experience and how they create networks. So as the child learns to experience the world, these networks are being solidified with experience.
And
that happens with touch, it happens with emotions, it happens with music perception.
I understand that babies understand rhythm or beat. That they understand that within days of being born.
Absolutely. In fact, that beat induction is very important because that's another way that they interpret the timing and speech and other things in their environment upon birth.
Well, is there a part of this, thank you very much, is there a part of this that we could pay attention to as we watch our infants being born? What do you see first? You see the child looking at things flying overhead, and it stares at the ceiling, and it watches things. But every parent I know, when you put on, you know, whenever they bring the child to your house and you put on music, they say, look, 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 he's dancing. I mean, it's a little boring to be told over and over again, look, 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 he's dancing. What's the big deal? The big deal is that we have manifested the sound through that ability of the child to interpret those rhythms and send them down to muscles and move parts of its body. That's amazing.
And it's important, too, because it's how the child learns to integrate movement and time. And, in fact, early on, we can see if there's a problem with a child in development when they don't have those types of typical responses to sound.
What kind of sound would, I'm going to ask this to both of you, as a neurologist as well, what kind of disturbances would you see if a child has an inappropriate, or not even inappropriate, but a mistaken response to what would be a normal response to a sound? Let's say they hear something rhythmic. Right? You know, it reminds me of The Jerk, with the movie The Jerk,
yeah,
where he danced one way and his family danced another. What kind of disturbance would there be? Would it be a palsy? A first suspicion, where you say, look, we play this music, and he waves his hands in circles.
Well, I would think about the cerebellum, which is what we think of as our little brain or our balance center. It also helps us to plan movement. And if a baby doesn't have a sense, sometimes a baby, when a baby is born deaf, they aren't able to sense certain sounds, and so they don't know to move to certain rhythms, and sometimes that can impede their ability to walk and do certain actions. But interestingly, even people who don't hear the rest of the hearing world hear, they can perceive sometimes beats and vibrations that sometimes we are less tuned into.
Mm. What do you think, Connie?
Oh no, absolutely. There's sometimes when you watch an infant listening to music or sound, you may see startle reflexes all the time instead of, you know, just nice movements to the sound, which also will give you a warning sign that something is happening.
I was at a friend's house the other day where he moved into a new house and he put on some music in the background. And he just had the music on because his child was there. And then he said to me, he was playing it to me from his
iPod,
his nano, and he said, And he said, listen to this, Armand, this is new. Now, he was a bass musician. He plays a bass guitar. Knowing I was a musician, he says, listen to this. And I heard something that was very strange. It was a guitar strumming with somebody singing off-key. And there was organization behind it. But as I listened to it, it sounded displeasing to my ears. Displeasing meaning, oh, this isn't familiar. But to young Michael, who's 30 years old, this is beautiful.
Right.
And I said, of course, I did not say, as my parents would have said to me, don't listen to that rock and roll, it's rotten. Or as their parents would have said, don't listen to Frank Sinatra, he's crazy.
Right.
Right? Instead, I listened and I said, there must be beauty in this that I'm not built to yet find until I'm familiar with it and may never find. Do you think that's true?
You hit it right there when you said, I'm not familiar with it, but maybe I could understand it or enjoy it if I were more familiar with it. That's exactly what happens, that we build, music isn't as universal as people think it is, because each of us brings to the world around us our own reactions and responses. And in doing so, create these expectations of what pleasing music is. And so depending on your background, depending on your culture, depending on what turns you on, music's going to be very different and have different associations and meanings. So, you know, when my first experience with opera was this very contemporary opera by Berg called Wozzeck, which to most people would say, my goodness, how can you possibly listen to that? And yet that was the first opera I ever heard, and I loved it. Mm-hmm. And yet, you know, another person would have said, no, only Puccini or some other composer would be the music for me. So all of us bring to our world a different set
of ears. Connie, that first time you heard opera, let me take this just a step deeper. What were you doing?
I was at a friend's house.
And your friend was a man or a woman?
A man. It was my boyfriend.
It was your boyfriend,
and
right?
And I was in high school.
So you're in high school. Now, if you're in high school and you're with your boyfriend, there's a lot of good stuff running around inside your body that's saying, ooh, love, 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 sex, love, 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 right?
Well, not sex in high school, but
well,
but
sex in
love.
Mind, you know what I mean? Sex hormones, things like that, and even though you're not having sex. But that's all running around, all this attachment, oxytocin, stuff like that. And now a young man plays you opera, and you listen, and he listens with reverence, and you listen with reverence, and you have your first reverent moment. You then will love opera.
Yeah, well,
I mean, regardless of the music.
Absolutely. It's very much associational.
That happened to me. I remember one man who, I used to listen to jazz all the time, and this one young man, this man who I knew, he was like 30 years old, and he said, let me take you someplace, and he brought me to a library, and he put on a pair of headphones, and he put on Mephistopheles by Boito, you know, the opera?
Yeah.
And he played the last act, the last scene. Now, if you're familiar with opera, this is probably the most dramatic piece of opera in the entire world. Everything. It's God, and it's the devil, and it's angels, and it's all this stuff, and it's trying to a fight between heaven and hell, and every 1,000 musical pieces, and I've got headphones on for the first time, and listening to this, and of course his hand on my shoulder. And I said, okay, I love opera. So we get conditioned into, but now I have a great question about music. If I played a few different pieces of music, one would have to ask, do we ever like or dislike anything, or could the only thing we say is that doesn't fit with my harmonic brain? I mean, I'm going to call Luke Jones. That's who I'm going to call. Why Luke? Because Luke is 21 years old, and he's in Cornell, and he's been listening to The Positive Mind on and off since he's been born. It's been around the background, and my music has been there. So I wonder if it's had an influence on him somewhere, because he's a brilliant young guy. We got to get him in here on air and talk to us about his appreciation of music. 21-year-old could tell us a lot of stuff. So I wonder if I play different music. My curiosity is, we're going to be talking about rhythm, we're going to talk about pitch, and what would happen as we analyze it? Would we learn something about ourselves rather than just doing what all our stupid parents did when they were teaching us about music, which is to reject whatever we loved and represent something else? Not all of our parents, but many of our parents. You were going to say, Sherry?
Oh, I was just going to...
You're back on a subject. Like, yeah. I'll go back there for a minute.
I just want to, you know, when you talk about evocative music that's evocative of emotions, as I understand it, Connie, tell me what you think about this, that music that people hear during their teens seems to be especially strong in evoking emotions in people.
Right. Well, there's been some research on music that people remember the best as they get older. And that particular music happens to be music that was popular during the teenage years. And when you think about how we develop to adulthood, it's those teenage years in the early 20s that we're really forming a sense of community, a sense of who we are, a sense of what embodies, you know, our identity with the world. And it tends to be the music we listen to during that period that reflects those feelings and those ambitions and those hopes.
And I think our emotions are also very, very strong during those times. Where
absolutely. We know that the teenagers, that the frontal lobes are still in development during the early teen years. And so those ways of reacting to the world emotionally, the inhibitions, the types of things that we learn about and develop during the teen years are also very active at that time. And you could see where music that evokes feelings and associations would also be part of that developmental stage.
And as I understand it, there's actual study. There is a study by Dr. Janata.
That's right, Peter Janata at UC Davis.
I'd love to hear more about that. As I understand it, he found that when certain music was played, there was a specific place in the brain. This was music that evoked a lot of emotion for different people, that a specific place in the brain lit up. As I understand it, it was the medial prefrontal cortex.
That's
big
correct.
Doctor language, but it really means it's the area on the front part of the brain. If you put your hand between your eyebrows and went backwards a couple of inches or an inch, you'd be right there.
That's right.
And so can you tell us?
Is that near the pineal gland, or would the pineal gland be right nearby?
The pineal's a little behind and below that.
A little behind and below that. Is it possible by stimulating one, you stimulate the other? Is it possible there's a link between the pineal gland and that?
There are a lot of different.
There's a lot of connections. Yeah, with that part of the brain, my understanding is where the network, the processings for the culmination of associations, a sense of self, emotions. All those tie-ins seem to be connected or processed in that area, at least when Dr. Janata did functional imaging or brain scans of the college students as they were listening to music of some autobiographical importance. Those were the parts of the brain that lit up, or at least that section of the brain, the medial prefrontal cortex, is what lit up consistently when they heard songs that they could say reflected a particular time in their life or were reminiscent of a person that they knew very well and, you know, situational type things like that.
Okay, we are talking with Dr. Sherry Siegel. Dr. Sherry Siegel is a neurologist and my co-host here on The Positive Mind, who generously gives of her time to do research, to bring us information, and some of this has been fabulous.
And we also have with us Dr. Concetta, or Connie Tomeno. She's the executive director and co-founder for the Institute for Music and Neurologic Function. She's also the senior vice president for music therapy at Beth Abraham. Some of you are familiar with Beth Abraham from the movie Awakenings. That was the hospital where Dr. Oliver Sacks had patients with Parkinson's disease who woke up when they were given medication. It was really an amazing
movie.
And
I think you worked with him, didn't you, Connie?
Yeah, we've worked together for the past 30 years.
That's incredible.
So we're learning, my friends, about music. What we're going to do today is a little experiment. We're going to take our break, which we're going to take in a little bit. And I want to go back to that teenage thing in just a minute. But when we take the break, I'm going to take an extended music break, and I'm going to bleed music into music. I want to see what music touches you and what music doesn't. I'll just play a couple of pieces. Would you, at the same time, tell us what clues you would look for Connie, what would you look for? So if you were trying to program music for somebody's brain, let's say you had somebody who had dementia.
Right.
Or let's say somebody who had a palsy, and you wanted a program for their brain. What responses would you look for that we might be able to observe in ourselves?
Sure. Well, for the person with dementia, we would look for a smile. We would look for their eyes to look alert, as if they're recognizing what's being played. A sense of calm and relaxation, because if music...
Well, what if it's high-beat music? Am I looking for calm and relaxation?
Well, no, if it's high-beat, then you'll see movement. What you want to see is some positive response.
What do I want to see in me as I listen to these pieces? I mean, am I going to just say to myself, do I like it, don't like it? Do I want to see my hands moving with it? Do I want to see my shoulders melting? Do I want to see myself relaxing?
Yeah, depending on the type of music, you want to see what you're feeling when the music is playing. And what
okay,
I mean by that is do you feel your feet, do you feel the impulse to move? If it's rhythmic, are you getting a sense of where the beat is? And do you feel this impulse to move around? If the music is slow and soothing, how does it make you feel? What emotion is going through your head? Is it reminiscence of something? Does it bring back a memory of something else? Is there an association to the
music? Well, I think you said something very important, and that is, does the music evoke a feeling? You know, there's some music that evokes no feeling, and I'll tell you, a lot of it is... what they used to call Muzak.
Right.
You know, when I hear what they call smooth jazz, it just doesn't evoke feeling for me. It doesn't. In fact, it evokes, it does evoke feeling. I get annoyed.
And
but
you know why that is?
Feeling.
You know why that is?
Well, not only because I'm a jazz musician.
But also because it's supposed to be background music.
Oh, it's supposed to
it's
be
the
background.
Most, it's not supposed to grab your attention.
So don't bring it to the foreground.
That's right.
Ah, I see.
So people who created Muzak actually took, if you hear it, it's not very rhythmic. It tends to have the same sort of range as far as amplitude. And it's
supposed to hypnotize you.
It's just supposed to be in the background to provide some minor distraction so you could do the work that you need to do.
You two are such wonderful information gatherers here. So I'm going to look for, when we play this music, I'm going to look for the different effects that it might have on you. Now, one is any feeling. A feeling of dislike may be a feeling. A feeling of sadness is a feeling. A feeling of joy is a feeling. Let's use the experiment to say, this is what it does to me. It makes my muscles melt. It makes me want to jump up. It sends me back in time. It moves my brain. You know, let's look at all the different, and we're just going to play like four or five pieces, and just see what it does to you. This will be the beginning of our experiment, and then we'll even take your calls. As we continue talking about this is Armand DeMille with you at The Positive Mind. We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we'll come back with the fabulous Dr. Sherry Siegel and the fabulous Dr. Connie Tomahino, and this is wonderful stuff. This is good stuff. I'm learning about why I like what I like. Next, you're going to tell me why I love tofu. I'll be back with you in a couple of minutes, my friends.
Yo, this is G-Love on WBAI, New York, New York.
TalkBack is your gathering place for the free and fair exchange of information and ideas heard here Monday through Thursday from 3 until 5 in the afternoon. I'm Hugh Hamilton. Join me as we explore the issues and events making news across the nation and around the world with expert guests, insightful analysis, and, of course, your comments, questions, and observations. That's TalkBack right here on WBAI New York.
Thank you, Rocky. This is Armand DeMille with you, the pilot of mine, Monday through Thursday here in Texas. You know, boy, if I had more time, I would love to have done that mixing a little better, but I kind of liked the abruptness of it, too. Kind of shifted me into moods. Well, Connie, what do you think?
It definitely did. I mean, that was brilliant, by the way. Just the assortment.
I'll keep a track of it. I'll make a CD for you to use over at the school.
Right. You know, it's amazing how quickly, for me, how quickly the mood can change and emotions. I mean, the violin piece haunting him.
That was my question. That was from The Red Violin, by the way, the movie.
Yeah.
The Red Violin. But my question was the following. After you go from that incredible drum selection rhythmic music that would get practically everybody, right?
Right.
You would use that with just about everyone?
Sure. Yeah, we can.
Connie,
the rhythmic music we can use with, people with... Hello?
I think we might have lost our connection.
Hello?
Oh, I'm sorry. There it is. Try it again. Connie, can you hear me?
Yeah.
I lost you for a moment.
Okay.
Okay, that drum selection music, how you go from that music piece to the violin, what happened to you as you listened?
Well, the rhythmic music, is very bouncy. I mean, I could feel myself moving and wanting to move. I actually got out of my chair and, I was moving around a little bit. And then the violin came in, and it's this haunting, longing melody completely changed. I mean, I completely changed from all of a sudden, moving around to like a heartache almost.
That heartache.
It's amazing.
There are people who are afraid of that heartache. And they're so afraid of that heartache that when they feel it, they want to reject the music. That music makes me cry. I don't want to think about things I don't want to think about, which is a famous line from Inherit the Wind.
Right.
Right? I don't want to think about things I don't want to think about. For some people, they'll reject the music because it has memory of sadness attached to it. Now, you, not afraid of your emotions, allowed yourself to sink into it, which meant your muscles melted.
Yeah.
You quieted down, and you could feel an emotion beginning to bubble. Is that right?
Absolutely. And that's the power, when we talk about the power of music, that's what music could do to people in the moment. At least it happens to me. I'm hoping your listeners felt some of that themselves. The important thing is that music can allow us to feel things sometimes that we're afraid of, too.
Mm-hmm.
And that can be incredibly therapeutic for people who have trouble dealing with things and maybe need a way of getting deep down and allowing those feelings to be expressed without fear of repercussion or, looking foolish or whatever, and in the quiet of their home being able to really feel deeply and let that experience come out and be released, which can be incredibly therapeutic for anybody.
And music seems to be a direct line to our inner brains and our feelings rather than thinking about the feelings.
Well, that's what you said before that really touched me, Sherry, when you said our vital emotional self is in our teen years. You know, in our teen years, we let ourselves feel more feelings because we have a body that is just burgeoning. It is building. It is everything's coming up. Hormones are shooting out from every direction. Muscles are building. You're getting stronger, more agile, less dependent. In nature, you're getting ready to spring off and have your own family and do stuff like that. So in a way, the music that you learned in your teenage years is your music of fertility. It is your vibrant music. And that's why somebody may or may not attach to teenage music much more than they do to other music. There's other people I know who would listen to opera with their fathers. And they'd listen, Dad, and they would listen. And then music, the opera music, brings them back to relationship with Dad or relationship with Mom. Or when we went dancing. So I think what Connie is saying, I'm sorry, is that she's saying music has a great potential for evoking in people emotions that they may not be able to express. There's a story about that. A man came to see me who's a jazz trumpeter. having known me as being a jazz musician, he came to see me, and he was in trouble with his family. And his family said, hey, why is he in trouble? He said, because they tell me I don't express anything that I feel. And I said, and I'd asked him what he'd feel, and he'd say, I don't know. So I said, bring in your trumpet next week. It was 6:30 in the morning. I remember it well. So he brought his trumpet in, and I said, what do you think of when you think about your dad? Well, no, first I said, what do you think when you think about your daughter? And he says, she's nice. I said, show me that on your trumpet. And he played me a piece that ba ba da ba ba da ba ba da ba 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 da. I said, oh, that's joy. I said, let's call that one joy. What do you think of when you think about your father? He said, oh, my father's dead. I said, but what do you feel when you think about him? He said, nothing. I said, play me what you feel. And he played a piece that was so mournful and so beautiful that it just ran through my heart. And I said to him, you see, that's sad. And he said, oh, that's what sad feels like. And we did therapy that way. I wasn't doing music therapy. I was doing therapy with a musician using some of the tools that I knew. I knew nothing about music therapy. Then came along people who were doing the meditation movement. And what they decided to do was use music as a way of quieting people because they learned that music could do it. And music went almost exclusively to the hands of the people who are doing meditation. And now what we think of when we think about people using music is we're using music how to calm yourself down. But that's also not music therapy. That's a tiny piece of it. Music therapy is yet to come. And I believe it's coming about now because we have a world that's screaming for it. Why do you think we have so many teenagers walking around with iPods screaming music into their ears all the time? Because something is changing, something is happening that's activating certain parts of the mind and body that can't get activated otherwise. Now I'll go to my question to both of you. What can loud, blaring music, I call blaring is a judgment, what could loud music do for somebody who is on a subway on their way to work where they don't want to be going? What is the difference between that and somebody playing meditation music? They're both doing the same thing, except the person playing meditation music hates overhearing the music of the person on the iPod, which I fully understand. What would you say?
It seems like they're both escaping, but one escaping from his or her anxiety by calming down and listening to meditative type of music. And the other person might be escaping from the humdrum, boring train ride or, you know, boring work that they might have with music that really excites and really where their body and their brain want to be. They're going there with their iPods.
What do you think, Connie?
I think she's absolutely right. I think that's exactly what's happening with people, that they use it to match either where they want to be or where they're at the moment.
Well, you see, now there's an important question because I would have perceived it differently. I would have seen it as preparation. Instead of escape, which it probably is, I would have seen it as they're preparing themselves for where they're about to go. They ask themselves, where am I now and what do I need to get there? So the person who might be very busy at home and then suddenly is taking a train ride into New York, says, what do I need to be able to enter that environment? I need to calm down. And so they put on the preparation for the future music, as opposed to the escape from the past music. And I think on the other hand, the same thing is happening for the people who are blasting themselves away. They should have special trains. You know, you should have special trains for people who want to be quiet. And people, like one that says no iPods, and the other one that says iPods welcome. And it would be kind of beautiful. But then everybody in the no iPod train would want their own kind of non-iPodic music.
Right.
You know, I come up the elevator almost every morning, and I come up here early. Sometimes I get here as early as 6 o'clock. I usually see somebody in the train, in the elevator with me. And I have a favorite phrase I say to everybody on a Monday morning. I say, are you ready? You know, and everybody knows what I mean. And they say, no, but I'm getting there. As they carry their little bag full of coffee. Let's go on with the music just a little further. The other music that you heard, when you heard the Beatles, what happened there? Does that go into rhythm? Does it go into music, or does it go into memory?
For me, it really touched my memories, I think, and it actually brought me to tears a little bit. And what was interesting about the violin music and even the opera, and I'm not an opera fan, I got chilly bumps. One of my patients used to call goosebumps, chilly bumps. And I felt them in different parts of my body, sometimes on the left, sometimes on the right. It was really curious and completely different from hearing the drum beat and Marvin Gaye when I just wanted to move around, like you were saying, Connie.
Do you know what I was playing, Connie, when I was playing that opera?
No, I didn't.
Ah, good. I tried to play it for you, and I wanted to introduce you to something quite beautiful. It's Non Piangere Lu. No, Signor Ascolta from Turandot. And okay. It's where he sings to her, "Please don't cry," and she sings back about why she cries, because she loves him so much. Uh-huh. A beautiful aria.
Yeah, absolutely gorgeous. I know the opera. I just couldn't pick it out independent of the piece. Fabulous.
What kind of disorders? What kind of things do we treat with
music?
You know,
let me just because people are listening and not to. I know we're going to talk about music therapy another time, but the field of music therapy, you know, has been around since the 50s, and there are music therapists who are trained to use. All of us who are trained and licensed in music therapy are really trained to use music in these nuanced ways to change behaviors and get people to think differently about themselves. And we either use it psychotherapeutically or more prescriptive, like in using rhythm to help people move. So I just want to make sure people understand that this isn't a new thing. What's new is our understanding of how it works. And so what you're talking about today and what people are hearing is our new, exciting understanding of why music is as important as it is.
Well, what do you do if you have someone at home who has, and you have someone at home who has some kind of either it's dementia or something like that, and they're kind of home going towards a vegetative state. What do you say that people should do besides bring them into a music program? What do you say? Bring home a drum?
Well, there's a couple of things. You know, we just launched the program in collaboration with the Rubin Foundation and Dan Cohen, who heads this program called Music and Memory. We're actually customizing iPods for people with dementia, working with their families to create song lists that can help engage them both physically, say if the person is very sedentary and the family member can't get them out of their chair, we can create song lists that have all those rhythms that you just played, you know, to get them up and
you mean somebody can actually call in and get help in customizing an iPod?
Right. It's called Well-Tuned Music Players for Health, and they could see it on our website at imnf.org. And we actually have people calling in from all over. We just launched it a couple of months ago. And people from all over the country are calling in and asking either for help, which we'll gladly do, and help them pick out the right songs. We get to know their loved one and what the needs are. If the person is, some people with dementia get agitated at certain times of the day, we'll help them find songs that can help relax the person or make them feel calm. And those are usually the piece of music that have those really strong memories attached to them, you know. So it's something we're trying to do because...
Okay, now that's... I still only have 2 minutes left.
Okay, sorry.
And we haven't told the audience anything they could do. We told them they could call you.
Yeah.
What do you do? Do you bring a little keyboard home to somebody who used to play piano and have their fingers on the keys and just see if they could produce a little sound? Do you bring drums in the house? I got a man next door to me who beats himself over the head all the time to create rhythm.
Absolutely.
You can do
all those things.
Be alert to the effect that music may have on them. Watch the effect of the music.
That's right.
Watch it as it happens to them.
That's right.
You know, see what it is that they're going through and see what you could offer them that may be, see what they respond to one way or another. And if you want to give it the attention, don't ask, do you like that, do you like that, do you like that?
Watch.
Because that's what you do.
Absolutely.
We watch. And it's in there that you get most of the responses.
That's it, right. Goes back to. Yeah. I'm sorry.
If you ask, if somebody has dementia, you don't want to talk too much because they're not going to understand what you're saying. You have to really be there in the moment, share the music with them, and watch their responses.
And with your terrific music section that you played earlier, Armand, what you asked us to do is to notice what we felt. I think just asking that question made me listen to the music differently than I normally listen to music.
Beautiful stuff. Well, yeah. We're out of time. Connie Tamiano.
Thank you so much. Yeah.
Connie, give me the web address once again, since what you do is for free. We'd love to give it out.
Sure. It's IMNF, Institute Music Neurologic Function .org.
And my special thanks to you. We hope to see you back here next week. You've got so much more to talk about it.
That'd be great.
Okay. And, of course, to you as always, thank you so much for being with us. 212. Oh, no. And if you want to send us an email, go through thepositivemind.com, and you can rehear today's program on WBAI.org. My good friends, I'll be back with you tomorrow.
This is Teokas and Ghost Horse, your host for First Voices Indigenous Radio. Join us on WBAI New York, Pacifica Radio, every Thursday at 10 a.m. The energies you will hear are always different, powerful, and not in the habits of entitlement, occupation, and ownership. First Voices Indigenous Radio on WBAI New York, Pacifica Radio, 99.5 FM, every Thursday at 10 to 11 a.m., it is a center of your radio digits, your radio dial, your radio scanner, and all you have to do is lock it in. They say if you repeat something three times, then one will remember it. So, First Voices Indigenous Radio, Thursdays on WPAI New York Pacifica Radio, 99.5 FM. It's a privilege to be here.
Aïe Bobo, c'est Manzé d'Aïla. Si vous voulez des nouvelles de Haïti et de Haïtiens qui sont dans la diaspora, virez radio sur WBAI 99.5 FM ou WBAI.org chaque jeudi à 9h pour Haïti. The struggle continues. Thank you for supporting People Powered Radio, WBAI New York.
You're tuned to Hi-Fi, WBAI 99.5 on your FM dial, New York.
Pencil.
Okay, this is Joe Franklin broadcasting on radio station WBAI.
It's 99.5% all natural and preservative free, WBAI FM in New York.
I love this radio station.
I certainly do, and I hope that you do as well. We are WBAI Radio, and we're located on the FM dial on your FM radio tuner.
Please remember that this program is supported by the listener members of WBAI New York. If you like what you hear, please consider becoming a member of WBAI or renewing if you've already joined. Basic membership is $25, but we accept any amount. Help us keep free speech alive.